Hey-ho, everybody, and welcome to the Pinhead Pod, the best Ramones fan podcast out there. I am your host, Dave. Thank you for joining me for yet another episode. Before we dive into everything, just remember this show is available on all major podcast platforms. And if we're not there yet, we soon will be. The show is also all over social media. It is on pretty much all the platforms. Just search for Pinhead Pod. Now, on this episode, my guest is going to be John Holmstrom, the founder of Punk Magazine and artist on the Rocket to Russia and Road to Ruins albums. That interview is coming up in just a bit. But first, let's take care of the news for May. The annual Joey Ramone Birthday Bash will be held on May 19th at the Bowery Electric in New York City. All net proceeds will go to benefit the Joey Ramone Foundation for Lymphoma Research. You can go to joeyramone.com for more information. On April 6th, the legendary Blondie drummer Clem Burke passed away. Clem, of course, played two shows with the Ramones as Elvis Ramone. He was 70 years old at the time of his passing. Ricky Rochelle has released yet another single. This one is called The Ghost of Dee Dee. Remember, Ricky is a musician from Long Beach, New York, who performs solo as well as with the Young Rochelles and the New Rochelles. You can find the single on all the streaming music platforms, and you can follow Ricky on all the social media platforms. Thanks to Ricky, you can hear that single at the end of this episode. Now let's move into our dates for May. May 4th, 1978, Tommy Ramone played his last show as drummer for the Ramones. That show was a benefit concert for Johnny Blitz at CBGB's in New York. Of course, Tommy did stick around for a while longer as producer. On May 19th, 1951, Joey Ramone was born. He was born Jeffrey Ross Hyman in Queens, New York, and his parents were Charlotte and Noel Hyman. On May 19th, 1986, the album Animal Boy was released. It was released by Sire Records. The album peaked at 143 in the U.S. Billboard 200. The album featured lots of tension between the band, and this led to Joey not being as involved in the writing as usual. The album has five songs contributed by Dee Dee, two by Joey, one by Richie, and four co-written by various members of the band. On May 22nd, 2012, Joey Ramone's second solo album, Ya Know, was released. It was released by BMG. Joey's vocals were pulled from demos recorded before he passed away. Music was overdubbed and included many friends of Joey's, including Joan Jett, Richie Ramone, Mickey Lay, Andy Chernoff, and much more. The album peaked at 180 on the U.S. Billboard 200. All right, though, that is all of our news and dates for May. Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we will have our guest, John Holmstrom, so stick around. If you like horror movies, be sure to check out Dave Dynasty and Ike Isaacs on the Listen to Their Screams Horror Podcast. It is available on all podcast platforms and on social media at Listen to Screams. That is Listen, the number two, and Screams. And welcome back to the Pinhead Pod. At this time, I'm being joined by John Holmstrom. Tell me about you. You grew up in Connecticut, right?
Yeah.
Yeah. And in the 60s and early 70s, you'd often go, you know, into the city, into New York. What types of things were you going to the city for?
Well, I grew up near New York. So as a kid, my mother would bring us once in a while. So I saw the World's Fair in 1965. We saw Penn Station before it was demolished. Empire State Building, that kind of thing. But the one trip that really got to me was when I went to see Jimi Hendrix at the Fillmore East, New Year's Eve, 69 to 70. And I was only like 16, but for some reason, my mom let me stay over here for a few days with my friend. So we explored the city, and the East Village was just amazing back then. Yeah. There was an underground bookstore with all of my favorite comic books and amazing books, record stores, restaurants. It was like, wow, if I could ever live here, this is where I want to spend the rest of my life. The next time I started going back is when I wanted to go to school. I applied to both Cooper Union, which is right in the middle of the East Village, and School of Visual Arts, which is just up on 23rd Street back then.
Yeah.
So the more I saw, the more I liked it.
Now,
I mean,
when you were going over, and then when you went there to school, I mean, this was when New York was still kind of rough though, right in part. I mean, it wasn't like later when they were, cleaning things up and so on and so forth, right? There was, it was kind of a rough New York. It was a different New York.
it was a high crime area here in the village from the 60s through to the early 90s. So, I'd see hookers and drug dealers all over the place. I never got mu I didn't get mugged when I first visited. I had a few break-ins and burglaries and stuff over the years. Early 90s, I had a gun pointed to my head and I was robbed. Growing up in Connecticut was more dangerous for me. I used to get beat up by bullies. I dealt with that situation, but I was always hassled by the police. I just didn't fit in. I didn't like small town life. I really loved living in the big city.
Well, I mean, the reason I kind of ask these things is, right, because all these things, right, this things happening, right, it's a the rougher edge of New York. Like, how much of that vibe that was going on in that city at the time do you feel was kind of the driving force and the reason behind some of the style and the sound of the music that started to emerge in the 70s in New York?
Well, the main effect was that you could get an apartment for cheap. When I went to school, I started going to school in September 72. I had a classmate who found a four-room apartment for $40 a month.
Wow.
But that was in a very dangerous area. I couldn't have hacked that. But I wasn't spending more than like $100 a month to be a roommate. When I finally got my own place, it was only 120 a month. When we rented the punk dump, our first office, it was only 195 a month, and it was an entire large store. So that was a driving force because you could work on your art most of the time. All you needed was a gig that paid a couple hundred a month, and you could exist.
Yeah, so then when did you start becoming aware of the music scene and start going to, once you moved to New York and the local scene and start attending more of the local bands and things like that?
Well, I was always a huge music fan, starting with what seeing the Beatles on the Ed Sullivan Show. And so I would go to see a lot of shows. I would hitchhike all over the country to go to those horrible outdoor rock festivals after Woodstock. And when I went to School of Visual Arts, there was a lot of crossover with the glam rock scene. Like one of my girlfriends was a big fan of the Dolls and would go to see them at the Oscar Wilde Room. I got into the local club scene after I saw the Dolls open for Mott the Hoople at the Felt Forum. And see, next time I saw them was the Academy of Music. It was a big show. But then, they started going downhill and played smaller clubs, so I'd go to see them there. But I liked the Dolls a lot. They were a good rock and roll band.
I mean, that was kind of the quote unquote pre-punk scene, right? There was a lot of that kind of more, you right, we I guess we consider now a little more straightforward rock, but there was a definite glam scene and people doing different things. Even I from what I've what I've seen, even the Ramones, right? Johnny at first was wearing like silver pants and things like that, and that was kind of the thing in New York.
Everywhere. Glam rock was huge. But there was no like binding principle behind it. It wasn't
Yeah,
like
right.
punk rock was like a social movement where glam rock was just a style of music.
Yeah.
And it would include everything from like Rod Stewart and Elton John to Alice Cooper and the New York Dolls. And my introduction to punk rock from reading Cream was that there were two kinds of glam bands, and one was kind of the mainstream, and then you had the more underground punk rock bands who played like a dirtier brand of music. And I was a big Alice Cooper fan. I saw them right before I moved to New York at the New Haven Arena. And I just thought that was, it's one of the best concerts I've ever seen, the Killer Tour, when
Yeah.
Alice hung himself and did all this crazy stuff. It was such a
Yes.
good show.
Well,
Still a big
so
fan.
by the time you got to New York, was Alice, was he no longer kind of, playing Max's all the time and stuff? Was that past that?
Oh, he's playing the Garden.
Yeah, right, okay. Right.
They were playing big shows.
Yeah, right,
I
okay.
saw him in New Haven. Blue Oyster Cult opened for them. And I became a
Yeah.
big fan of Blue Oyster Cult. And you look at Blue Oyster Cult. I mean, Patti Smith wrote lyrics for him.
Yeah.
Richard Meltzer, who really was, the mind behind the punk rock thing more than Lester Bangs.
Yeah.
Helen Wheels wrote for them. They do a kick-ass version to kick out the jams on their double live album.
Yeah.
They were kind of they were thought of as kind of the thinking man's heavy metal band. They
Yeah.
weren't as dumb as Black Sabbath, but I was never a big fan of. So
Yeah.
I was just all into a lot of different kinds of music. I saw Roxy Music when they opened for Jethro Tull at the Garden. And that's when I kind of got off mainstream rock music forever, because Jethro Tull was just awful. And Roxy Music wasn't great, but they were interesting. And sometimes, they don't have to be great. A band can just
Sure.
be different and something you never heard before that makes it more interesting than your bar band, your typical bar
Yeah.
band playing top 40, which was really bad back then. I mean, you needed to hear something besides the average white band covers.
Yeah, I don't remember. Ah, oh, man, I can't remember who I saw. I saw an interview clip, right, where they said they saw saw the Ramones, right, early on when they first started. And said they went and saw them on a show. When they left, they said they were so pissed off because they were so horrible, so awful. They were just pissed the whole night, but then they went back the next night and saw them again.
I heard that story, yeah. Well, I ran across a video on YouTube that featured a lot of their very early videos. And yeah, they were awful.
Yeah.
Would not have liked them if I saw them when they first started.
Yeah.
There's a rumor out there that Legs McNeil went to see them the first time they played there, which is a total fabrication because that kid was still in high school. I first saw the Ramones in August 75 at their Summer Rock Festival at the tail end of it, very end of August. And there were only like a couple dozen people in the audience, but I was blown away. I thought they were one of the best bands I'd ever seen.
Yeah. Yeah, well, that's what, Hilly Crystal, right, always said that when he first started booking on CBGBs, right? He's like, these guys are awful. They can't even get through a song without, fighting or something blowing up or a string breaking or something happening. And he didn't think much of them. And but they when they found their groove and found their thing and whatever, it started hitting. When did you first discover CBGBs?
I heard about it. I saw the Dolls at a place called Little Hippodrome. It was the last show in New York. And Television with Richard Hell played open for them. It was the last time Richard was in the band. So I went to see him, and then this cute girl picked me up and told me, we could get in the after party. So we hung out, and she's telling me about this place called CBGB, which is, sawdust and dog crap on the floor, and all these, she told me about the great bands that play there, and you got to go there. So that was my real introduction to it. But then I read about the Summer Rock Festival in the Village Voice in an article about James Wolcott and Lisa Robinson, who really started the scene.
Yeah.
You know, she introduced, she suggested to Danny Fields that he would want to manage the band, and he did. But she wrote about them in Cream, and of all things, her fashion column. And just looking at them, I was like, wow, these guys dress like me.
Yeah.
Blue jeans, sneakers, t-shirt. You know, I would go to see the Dolls, and everybody's dressed to the nines, and I was broke.
Yeah.
I show up in my jeans jacket and my ripped, you know, my old t-shirt and you know, my old jeans and my beat up sneakers, and I would feel so out of place.
Well, yeah, you mentioned right at the top, we talked you right. You're by heart, you're by craft, you're an illustrator, cartoonist. So on a little bit of a sidebar, I have to ask because I'm a comic book guy. In 75, you worked under Will Eisner, right? Who created the Spirit? I mean, essentially helped create graphic novels. Kind of one of the driving forces between kind of an academic study of comic books and different things. Like, what was it like, you know, working under him? And because I mean, hell, there's awards named after him now for you know, artists and things like that. And what was it like, you know, working under Will Eisner?
Yeah, well, I helped get both him and Harvey Kurtzman hired by the School of Visual Arts.
Oh, yeah.
There was a cartoon club. I was too busy working to join, but they put together a petition to hire somebody to teach comics because a bunch of us went to School of Visual Arts to learn how to draw comics.
Yeah.
And they didn't have any classes in it. So they knew I was good with the president, Silas Rhodes. For some reason, he liked what I did. So I gave him the petition and met with him. And the first two names on the list of people we wanted as teachers were Will and Harvey. And he went out and hired them. So I spent a year, my last year. I only spent 2 years at School of Visual Arts. I couldn't afford to go anymore. But that, you know, the last year with Will and Harvey as teachers was amazing. Like Harvey would bring in all these special guests. So we met Jack Davis, David Levine, very famous illustrator, Robert Grossman, famous art brush illustrator, Art Spiegelman, and Rick Griffith, who did Zippy the Pinhead. You know, just dozens of professionals. Dan Wilson, I met. It was amazing, but I was a really good student. Like I showed up every single minute of every single class, and I was participating and asking questions and soaking up everything like a sponge. But you know, when I had to drop out of school, I became homeless, and so both those Harvey and Will kind of came to my rescue. I was Will's apprentice for a while, making minimum wage. Sweeping the floors and stuff. And then Harvey hired me to do a couple freelance assignments. And he introduced me to the cartoon editor at Playboy. And she gave me advice. Like she sent me the Screw magazine. Now the art director there turned down my work. But he was on his way to the New York Times. It was pretty shocking news at the time. The art director at Screw ended up at New York Times, and he worked there forever. You know, he yeah. also taught at the School of Visual Arts. He was the top guy in design.
Yeah.
So, you know, I made my way around, and I started to get published. Harvey sent me to Scholastic. They were starting a magazine called Bananas.
Yeah, I was going to ask. Yeah, I want to ask you about Bananas.
Yeah,
because I remember, right? I'm a little younger than you, right? I remember Bananas magazine, and I remember your stuff, right? Bosco Joe, the cartoons and their stuff, right? From like the mid 70s into the 80s, and I guess you know I knew who you were, right? I'd heard of you, and I knew that magazine, but I guess I never until I started kind of prepping for this, I never made the connection. That was you. that did those.
I did the comic strip Joe for 10 years. My editor was Jovial Bob Stein. His wife, Jane, was the editor at Dynamite, but I never worked for them. After the magazine folded, Jovial Bob turned to the dark side and he became R.L. Stein.
Oh, okay. You have Goosebumps fame. There you go.
Yeah, his wife was the publisher, and Bob was churning out these Goosebumps stories. And it was so ironic because both of them worked as employees of Scholastic, but Goosebumps became like the biggest property of Scholastic.
Still, I mean,
So
still it, right? They still, I mean, there's a new streaming show for it. I mean, it's still a huge property.
Yeah.
And though that's
But
wild. I didn't know.
I'm so happy for Bob. He was one of the best people.
Yeah.
He was probably the best editor I ever had. He always helped fix a weak punchline. So he would write the ending of half the comic strips, and he was very encouraging and treated me with so much respect. He was the best. He's the best.
Yeah,
And he
I mean, I'm very familiar with R.L. Stein, right? My kids grew up reading it, but I had no idea that R.L. Stein worked on Bananas as well.
Oh yeah. They
That's
had a great crew. Suzanne Lord was up there, and she was she was a relative of Preston Sturges, one of the great screwball comedy directors. You
It's
ever seen
what's
Preston Sturges movies?
no, I don't know. I'm not without knowing what some of his titles are. I'm not sure.
I urge you to see Sullivan's Travels.
Okay.
Yeah, it's a really great movie. Veronica Lake, and I think it's Joel McRae. But he did so many great movies. Hail the Conquering Hero with Eddie Bracken, The Lady Eve with Henry Fonda, and I forget the name of the, might have been Claudette Colbert. Their first movie was The Great McGinty. I think he sold the story for $1 on the condition he could direct it. And it's about politics. It's one of the great political satires.
Yeah. It's wild. I mean, for someone who wasn't around that time, Bananas and Dynamite Magazine, it's hard to grasp how huge those were at the time. I mean, they were, especially, I guess, through the Scholastic, because Scholastic was in every school library, school book fair, everything. I mean, you couldn't be a kid or whatever and not know what those were. And I mean, you mentioned, right? Go ahead.
It was a great gig for me because they paid a couple hundred a page. And that first page I sold gave me the money to help rent the Punk Dump and start the magazine.
Yeah, right. Because you mentioned, right, that there came a time, right, when I think when Will kind of closed up his office thing or whatever in his studio and stuff. And you ended up, you were kind of, you were doing these things, but you were looking for some more money, right? And you said Legs hooked you up with Jed Dunn painting some houses, right? He was painting houses.
Well, I knew Jed already.
Okay.
But yeah, he had a house painting business, and Legs was Eddie was before he was Legs. Wanted to recruit me to be in some independent film he was going to make, and Jed was financing it. So, and he had an apartment in the middle of town. So Will would always take a summer break. He'd close the office for a few months. So I had nothing to do, no source of income. So, I stayed with Jed in his apartment in the middle of Cheshire, Connecticut. It was right in the middle, right by the green, the town green. And we'd paint houses during the week and then shoot on weekends.
Yeah.
And I played the dictators for him and told him about the punk rock scene and everything. And Jed was like, yeah, this is fun. Maybe we can work together someday. And then, once we left, I was like, yeah, I'm doing work for these guys and these other guys. And Eddie was working for a film commune, making movies. And Jed felt like it was going to be too late to work with us if he stayed in school. So he dropped out. He had $5,000, it's about 50,000 in today's money. And, we rented the office and put out the magazine, and the rest is history.
Yeah, I mean, and for those, I mean, who don't, know any better, right? The kind of the, I guess almost an urban legend or whatever you want to call it, is it was you and Legs, but it wasn't you and Legs. It was you and Jed. And
Exactly.
yeah. And
Yeah,
I mean, Legs was
Eddie
around.
helped out. Eddie helped out.
Yeah, and he helped you come up with the title, right? I mean, kind of gave
yeah.
you, kind of an offhand conversation, right? Say, hey, why don't you call it, just call it Punk? And,
Well, they turned down the first two names I came up with, which would not have been like a punk rock magazine. It would have been a
yeah.
more general interest thing.
Yeah.
But I wanted punk rock to be like the main music. And so in his exasperation, I said, well, what do I call a magazine, with humor and fashion and sports and all about punk rock? And Eddie said, why don't you just call it punk? And I thought, four-letter word, perfect.
Yeah, and like you mentioned earlier, right? Punk was had been used by Cream Magazine, that the term punk. Is that kind of the first time you, I mean, that was really used in that context, was with Cream, that people knew of,
Oh,
in referring
yeah.
to the music scene and everything
Especially
else?
in 74, it was used a lot. Like, Alice Cooper was punk of the year.
Yeah.
They would do an annual readers poll. And one of the categories was punk of the year. So I was a huge fan of Cream Magazine. And they were the only magazine besides Rock Scene really covering the punk scene and saying good things about the New York Dolls or the Ramones or the Dictators. Dictators got a great review in Cream, while the other rock magazines put it down.
Yeah, Cream. Yeah, Cream was kind of always like that, right? It always had more of an open mind about what they would cover, not just, I don't know. It's almost like they didn't worry about that slant of, oh, well, who could we put on the cover to sell an issue? They were covering, shit they liked. I mean, I would assume. It's weird when you, for today's people to think, when you started this. Because, right, you guys, like you said, you and Jed, right, decided, and Lace was the name, where, and you just kind of, it's weird to think, you just dove in, right? I mean, you approached Lou Reed, right, there, and just say, hey, we're going to interview you for your magazine. Lou's like, oh, cool, we're going to put you on the cover. Oh, you're going to be great. I mean, you didn't really have a magazine yet. And it's just, it's crazy to think in this day and age how you could just do that, the way the scene was, that you could just kind of dive in, and approach guys like that. To get this started and it work, it just fall into place, right? Because that, I mean, that first issue, right? You had Lou on the cover, an interview, right? You interviewed the Ramones, right, and everything, because they were there, right? They were part of the scene and approachable.
Yeah, well, we went down a Sunday night after Thanksgiving. There was hardly anybody in the audience. I think there's a YouTube video of a phone conversation Lou Reed had where he's raving about how great the Ramones were. And that was in early November. So Lou's in the audience and Danny told us about it. And I was a big Lou Reed fan from the Velvets to his solo work. I actually was in the audience for Rock and Roll Animal at the Academy of Music.
Oh, yeah.
So I was ready to talk to him. And the thing is, I was unafraid of meeting him. He wasn't my idol. I actually had Thanksgiving dinner that weekend at Harvey Kurtzman's, where Robert Crumb, my hero,
Oh.
was having dinner with us.
That's okay.
And that,
Oh,
once
okay.
you meet
Hold
your
up.
hero, like
That's nuts, right? I mean, we're talking, right? The king of the underground comics. And okay, so let's sidebar here. What is it like sitting at a table, breaking bread and conversing with Robert Crumb?
Oh, when you're just a fanboy and your career's not established yet, it's just the greatest, But I felt like that meeting all those guys, like meeting Jack Davis. I mean,
yeah,
he's not as well remembered now, but at the time, he was making so much money doing so much commercial work. Like when he did his demonstration for us, he was so fast And he shows us his work. He was doing covers for Time magazine. And he
Yeah.
described how he'd meet with the editors in the conference room. And they'd talk about ideas for the cover. He'd go in the other room with his tools and churn out like 10 to 15 sketches for the cover in 20 minutes.
That's nuts.
Yeah. He did a drawing in front of us, and I was the guy who said, "Can I have the sketch?" Which I still have. So, you know, I've always been unafraid to be a pain in the ass. But that a lot of that comes from my experience in acting in junior high school and high school. I was always the star of the high school plays. So it gave me the confidence to act like an asshole and, you know,
Yeah.
just
Were,
be
I
a
mean, were these guys approachable, right? Because it's a different culture then, right? There's not all these conventions and whatever the guys like that are going to that are, where there's tons of fans, right? They're not getting recognized as openly as they are current artists would be. So, I mean, when you would come up, were they appreciative, approachable that you recognized them and appreciated what they did?
Sometimes. There were conventions back then. They were starting to happen. I went to my friend Batten A. Lash, who did Exhibit A, you know, Zombie Wife and Supernatural Law. He was my best friend when I went to School of Visual Arts. We were both huge Steve Ditko fans, so we bonded right away. And so he took me to Creation Con, and that's where we saw Vaughn Bodie do the first cartoon concert in New York. And we were just blown away, and we decided to do our own cartoon concert as a school project. And you know, Vaughn was pretty well known. He was cartooning for the National Lampoon at the time. He had a good crowd when he did his show, but he would just be hanging out, you know, buying comic books at the tables and talking to people. He was very nice, very approachable. I had long conversations with him over the next few years. You know, sadly, his death happened right as I was starting Punk Magazine. Shortly after he came out during a cartoon concert. So, you know, but I remember seeing Isaac Asimov hanging out, Neil Adams lying on the floor surrounded by fans, like talking shop. You know, you'd meet so many people. I remember we met Jerry Iger once, who was Eisner's business partner. We kind of had coffee with him and talked to him for a few hours. Bat and I visited Carl Burgos, who started the Human Torch. He was putting out these really horrible horror, black and white horror magazines. And they're like, "Hey, you did the Human Torch?" And he's like, "Yeah, the worst thing of my life." And he was like, not too happy. But we experienced so much then. I remember meeting Jim Starlin. We were big fans of Jim Starlin.
Yeah.
And we talked to him in 75 before I started the magazine. He was like, "Whatever you do, don't work for Marvel Comics. They're the worst. They'll eat your soul." But it was like that. I mean, they didn't recognize creators' rights. And copyrights were a big thing back then. And ownership of original artwork. You know, like you'd work for Marvel and they would keep your original artwork.
Yeah.
You know, you'd put all this work into your, you know, comic strip and it would belong to someone else. It was, you know, so that's why you had to go independent. You had to start your own thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this was, of course, this was, you know, prior to the huge boom of, you know, creator owned stuff, you know, creator owned comics, independent comics, things like that. But, I mean, I guess, well, what they had then was they were calling underground, right? I mean, that's what that was. I mean, that was kind of guys doing their own, you know, wacky stuff, what they wanted to do and everything else, which obviously was, you know, was a big thing on you. You said, you know, when you were a kid, you were going into New York to get those underground comics and influenced you. And then, like I said, you and Jed starting, you know, Punk, you know, with Lou Reed and everything else. When you put that first issue out, how was it received?
Horribly. I went to a Comic-Con that as soon as it came out, I figured, hey, it's a hybrid of comics and rock and roll. who's going to say no? Out of like the 30 to 40 tables, only one guy bought a few copies. Some guy was running a comic book shop in Texas. I wish I could remember his name, because I saw him many years later and he remembered me. It was so nice. But yeah, it was actually Bill Griffith, you know, the Zippy the Pinhead guy, was starting something called the Cartoonist Co-op Press. And he was encouraging me to publish my own comic book with him. And they would be doing, like, to save money, they would do a whole run of comic books together. So the idea of self-publishing came early. And, of course, my father published his own book before I was born, of his one-time experiences with his drawings. So it was kind of in my blood about doing your own magazine. The Kurtzman, there's an incident at Kurtzman's class too, where he had the school print something and they didn't like a certain comic strip and they almost, they refused to print it. But Harvey insisted on it. But after that, he had us print our own stuff and put together our own magazine. So the path was clear. You know, if you want artistic freedom, you've got to work for yourself.
Yeah. Well, I mean, and you said, you know, the first issue was not well received, right? And you're not getting a lot of people, you know, buying in to help you. So, I mean, so how, if shops and stuff aren't getting on board, how are you distributing it? Or is it just not, or not really getting the distribution you're hoping because you can't get shops on board? I mean, are you self-selling any of it at clubs and stuff, or how's this?
Jed Dunn, the publisher, found a distributor, and they actually got us on newsstands. Like, okay. Lou Reed saw it on a newsstand, picked it up. He had forgotten he did the interview, and he was blown away. Lou loved it, and he wanted to meet me, so we met at CBGB's. There's some photos of it by Danny Fields. And, you know, we ended up becoming friends, and he ended up contributing to the magazine. Like, certain people got it. Lou understood what we were doing. Joey Ramone, and especially Chris Stein of Blondie. Chris and Debbie ended up doing a lot of stuff with us. Like, the intelligent people liked it. But the people who wanted to make it in the music business or whatever and weren't interested in starting a whole new revolution in music didn't get it, didn't like it. We were kind of a joke among most of the fans at CBGB, because we wrote too much about the Ramones and they all hated the Ramones. But it took off in England. And that's why people think punk rock started in England, because those kids bought into it and started bands and, you know, were inspired by the Ramones and the Dolls and all the stuff I liked.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of people, I mean, you know, the Ramones were struggling along a club band until they went to England, and they were over. I mean, they were, you know, it was a different level for them over there.
Well, I think the famous Roundhouse gig, they actually opened for the Flamin' Groovies, which is a good idea for booking, because the Flamin' Groovies were one of those San Francisco bands who actually played rock and roll instead of psychedelic stuff.
Yeah, and I mean, and you mentioned, right, the Ramones, because you said you covered the Ramones a lot. You mentioned your Blondie and the set. I saw, read somewhere or whatever, in another interview you did, where you said that you kind of felt the magazine kind of became a, almost like a CBGB newsletter, and that was kind of a mistake, that maybe, you know, you should have been more diverse. I think you even said that in that second issue, maybe you should have centered on a film or something completely different, and maybe that was, you know, kind of a marketing mistake on your part. Was that, I mean, do you kind of stand by those thoughts?
I don't know. We had a lot of problems. Like, the biggest problem was Jed didn't know what he was doing. He was in over his head. I think he insisted on interviewing Patty, whose management did not want us to talk to her. because they wanted her to be mainstream and they didn't want to be attached to the CBGB scene. That was a thing most people probably don't understand. The bands that played CBGBs couldn't wait to get out of that place. You know? I mean, you know, at first there were no dressing rooms even. And before Hilly built the new stage in the middle of 77, that small stage was like probably the worst stage in New York. Sound wasn't great. But, you know, they wanted to play the Garden. They wanted to be big. But all the fans wanted the bands to play CBGBs forever. They wanted to be nice and cute and cuddly and small. So it's hard to tell. The big mistake made with the punk, with us putting all these other bands in the magazine was they ended up being labeled punk. So Blondie was called a punk band and Talking Heads were a punk band, but they weren't. But there weren't any other punk bands to write about. You know, we got Iggy. We did the Ramones on Punk number three. We did Richard Hell in a photo comic for number six. But there wasn't even, I mean, we started so early. There was not much to write about. We put the Sex Pistols on the cover of the eighth issue because they, you know, that's who we should have been writing about, but nobody'd heard of them yet. They didn't bring out a record yet. Or they had just brought out their record. Nobody in America heard of them. And even when they toured, not, you know, people knew about them, but they were kind of a joke because of the bad publicity they got. The world just wasn't ready for what we wanted to do.
Well, yeah, it's always easy, right, to with modern eyes to look back on a scene and whatever else. But you guys, I mean, you and the band, I mean, this the scene was developing, right? It wasn't even a scene like we would view it now. I mean, it was just there wasn't a lot of places to play original music, and they were playing CBs because, you know, it's like to get some, you know, to get work, to get gigs, they were having to, and you guys were trying to do your thing, but you were just kids, right? I mean, you were just kids trying to do it and cover and be a part and. It's everybody. I don't know. It's weird. It's like when you look back on a time period, you see it differently. But within it, everybody's just winging it, right? Trying to do their thing and find their path.
Well, there was a punk scene. You know, once we started the magazine, we'd hear from Gulcher. You know, they're putting out their own kind of punk scene in the Midwest. You had bands like the Gizmos, who were, you know, a lot of people were fans of the Stooges. And of course, the Saints out of Australia brought out their single on their own label, I'm Stranded. And it became single of the year in 1976. And listen to that thing, it's punk rock. And it came out in 76 out of Australia. So there was a worldwide thing. Hay fever. So it wasn't like we didn't, there was no punk scene. There was. It was just really small. Like Suicide was around. I mean, Suicide was pure punk, even though they were a techno band. They would fit in, they were the first band to call themselves a punk band. The pub rock scene in England was gaining ground. And to me, bands like Eddie and the Hot Rods, they were called punk rock by the English press in 75. So it was kind of an ill-defined genre, if you will. But I think that's why the Ramones to me were the first real pure punk rock band. And I don't like the term proto-punk. I would call the bands before the Ramones punk rock and roll. There was always an element to what punk rock took from the past that could be defined as punk. People are always saying, oh, well, the Sonics were the first punk band, or the Who's first album was punk, or, you know, listen to very early rock and roll music. It has everything punk had. It was rebellious. It was fast. It was loud. It was, you know, it was simple. The drumming style was similar to punk because after After the British invasion, you ended up with what was called heavy rock, like vanilla fudge. You know, they'd have a double bass drum and 10 tom-toms and a snare and a million cymbals for a drummer. And of course, this is why Tommy Ramone had to play drums for the Ramones. There were no rock and roll drummers left who had a simple drum kit and just kept the backbeat going. You know, they all needed to do their solo and whatever.
Yeah, it's some of that early rock, right? That people say, oh, it's almost punk. But yeah, but that's what bands like the Ramones and those bands, that's they were trying to get music back to that style, right? It's like, let's break down and cut through the pretension and the bullshit that had emerged in the 70s, you know, was emerging in the 70s, and let's just get back to a, you know, a basic rock and roll. And that's
Well, that was the thread that would unite Talking Heads, Blondie, Ramones, and a lot of the other bands of CBGBs. We were rejecting progressive rock and top 40 and trying to start a new music based on the 60s. Like the Talking Heads, everybody said, oh, you gotta see this band. The singer looks like Anthony Perkins from the Psycho movie. And they play a song called Psycho Killer, and they cover 1, 2, 3 Red Light by the 1910 Fruit Gun Company. And Blondie was, you know, was very inspired by 60s music then. So, you know, there were no drum solos at CBGB's. There were no guitar solos. It was all like playing rock and roll like we liked it.
And you know, and through that, right, you said you know, you covered the Ramones, got to know the Ramones, you were a fan of the Ramones, and then in 77 you did the artwork for Rocket to Russia. Some of the rock, you know, you did that, the what, the back out, you know, right, the what, the pinhead on the rocket and all that was you, right?
I did the drawing. Johnny Ramone came up with the concept. I wouldn't have done some of the stuff that he wanted me to do, but I figured, like, my father was a commercial artist, and you learn to do what your client wants. You deliver the job. It's not like fine art where you just do whatever you want and expect the world to like it. But I was actually involved in the first ever Ramones 45. We had done a centerfold for Punk Number Three, Blitzkrieg Bop, where Danny Fields gave me eight photos and I did word balloons with the lyrics for Blitzkrieg Bop. And that was the first single. And Tommy came to me. He's like, look, we don't have a budget, but we'd like to use your comic strip from Punk as the sleeve for Blitzkrieg Bop in the United Kingdom. And then, of course, you know, Roberta Bailey was starting to shoot for us. And I wanted her to shoot the Ramones for issue number three. And Johnny wanted someone else, but I knew how good Roberta was. She had done something for us for issue number two that didn't come together. And so I said, I'm sorry, you know, you'll get the next assignment that comes across. And it happened to be the Ramones. And she came up with the iconic photo of punk rock, you know? So I think at that point, Johnny wasn't happy with Leave Home. So he hired me to do the back cover. But that first he just wanted the inside sleeve. My first idea was to hire different people from punk and use some Roberta Bailey photos and make kind of a mishmash of cartoons and photos. But then Johnny, when he saw the first few things, said, no, I'd rather have you do all the drawings. Can you get them done? Get them to me in a day or two. So I had to do knock out 12 drawings in a few days. I'm no Jack Davis.
Well, I mean, regardless of anything, right? That back cover, I mean, that it's an iconic piece of Ramones history.
Yeah, well, that's when, you know, when Johnny saw the inside sleeve, he's like, why don't you do the back cover too? And that's when he gave me, you know, do the pinhead on the missile, you know, reminiscent of Dr. Strangelove, et cetera.
Did you feel a little bit, I mean, because I mean, these guys, obviously, if you look at their careers, had an appreciation for comic books. and some of that. Was that ever a, kind of a kinship with them?
Not
And
really. DD read a few comics, and Johnny would wear Popeye t-shirts and so forth. But
yeah.
I didn't connect with them on with comics. But comics became this art form for nerds
Yeah.
as time progressed. But when I was reading underground comic books in the 60s and early 70s, they were kind of rock and roll. They were the cool kids,
Yeah.
And that's what I tried to do with punk is, make comics a part of rock and roll. Because I always thought there was a relevance between the two art forms, like
Yeah.
post-war, rock and roll begins. And comic books start doing Vault of Horror and the EC Comics and Mad
Yeah.
Magazine, and then you had the Senate hearings, and they censored all the horror comics, just like they cut the balls off rock and roll when early rock and roll died when the plane crash with Buddy Holly and the Big Bopper and Elvis joins the army and Jerry Lee Lewis loses fans because he marries his cousin. But that, you get into like the early 60s and everything's kind of safe as milk. But then around the time the Beatles start, you had the Fab Four and the Fantastic Four. The Beatles and the Fantastic Four and Marvel Comics begins. And it's at the same time, garage rock and the British Invasion and all this exciting rock and roll is beginning. There was always kind of a thing about rock and roll and comic books that I thought was kind of a unifying force. I mean, you could even go back to like blues and jazz and newspaper comics.
Well, you also did the cover for Road to Ruin in 78, which is probably, I mean, it's probably one of the most iconic pieces of art, in the Ramones. But what they, what they put on the cover, it was tweaked a little from your kind of your original idea, right? I saw the somewhere I saw the sketch of what you originally did.
I was shown the sketch, and Johnny asked me who should draw it, and we said Wally Wood. I
Right.
said Wally Wood, but also apparently Bobby London was involved. Arturo Vega. Everybody thought Wally Wood would be perfect, and it would have been, but Wally was too sick to do it, so he gave it to his assistant Paul Kirshner, who was a dope writer for High Times. I actually ran into him a few months ago, and we talked about the whole thing. And he realized he just couldn't communicate with them. Like, they couldn't get their idea for the cover across to him. They just wanted this fan sketch the Scottish kid did, Gus McDonald. They just wanted it redrawn without some of the elements. And Tommy was leaving the band, so they wanted Marky in the drawing. So I delivered the job very quickly, but it was just a job for me. I didn't have much to do with creating the image.
Okay, so they had that original sketch from that kid, right? And it had Tommy in it, had, I don't know what, some snakes and different things. It was all that stuff. So they liked it, but they wanted some things tweaked. So they said, oh no, whatever, put Mark in it, take the snakes out, clean it up a little, and that's just so you that's what you did. And
The drawing you see, kind of a pencil drawing by Gus McDonald, is not really the original sketch that I was working from. I wish we had a reproduction of that somewhere. It appeared in Sounds Magazine once, because apparently, I mean, Linda Stein, Seymour's wife, assured me that Gus would get paid $300 for use of the sketch. But months later, after the record comes out, Gus wrote to Sounds with his sketch and said, "I did the original idea and I never got paid." It made me feel like really bad for the guy, because I was deceived and he was deceived. But that's rock and roll. It's a bit. a lot of people get screwed.
Yeah. Well, like with that, right? You said that, they kind of had a pretty definitive idea what they wanted you to kind of do with, with that sketch and everything else. But like you said, with the other, with Rocket to Russia, they were a little more, was it hit or miss what they came as far as direction on these things like this? I mean, whether they would have ideas or not, or just come to you and say, oh, we need something, do it, we like this, or I mean, was it just kind of all over the place?
The Ramones always had problems thinking up the record cover, like the first cover. They hired some professional photographer, and I think they wanted it to look like Meet the Beatles, the first Beatles record cover, but it turned out horrible. So they were desperate to find a cover image, and Roberta had just shot the cover for us, shot the photos of the Ramones for us. And before I got a chance to look at them, she sent the negatives to Sire Records. And that's where those guys, John Gillespie, the art director, and Seymour, and everybody would chose that image by Roberta to be the perfect cover, which it is. Roberta was only paid like $200 for it, where they paid the professional probably a lot more. Leave Home, the band hated it. They had to get up at 6 in the morning for the photographer. They wanted to do it at sunrise or whatever. Johnny always hated having his photo taken anyhow, which didn't make things easier. Rocket to Russia, they saved money on the front cover by having their manager, Danny Fields, shoot it, and they just try to imitate Roberta's first cover. Like with Pleasant Dreams, I think I have the CD, and they actually have an early version what they wanted it to look like. And I think it's the worst cover they could have ended up with. That horrible, simple graphic of some guy in the shadows. They never came to me and said, John, would you like to do a cover for us? Like they were pissed off that Road to Ruin didn't sell better. And I think they blamed it on the cover, but the cover is also kind of expensive. We added a fifth color. The deadline was so tight. I did a bunch of overlays instead of just a few. But I stand by it. I think it came out really good. But yeah, Johnny was always about the bottom line. What does it cost? What's the return?
Well,
And
tell me,
when it didn't sell well, I think Johnny blamed the cover.
I don't know about that. But tell me, I read a thing that ends, I think the mid-80s or whatever. I think there was an article in Spin magazine that Legs McNeil, that you talk about Eddie, and that you took some heat with Joey Ramone about it because your name was credited to it, but you didn't write the article. What was that whole story about?
Yeah, well, I was really struggling. I was between jobs. I'm not getting much freelance work. And so Eddie offered me the opportunity to work on a Ramone story. And we were going to tell the truth that they're not brothers. Shock. Unbelievable. And they didn't always get along. So I sat in an interview with Joey because nobody trusted Legs. And that was it. And then Legs writes the story. It comes out in Spin. I walk into Paul's lounge. All four Ramones are there. And they're like, we ought to kick your ass. I'm like, what? What'd I do? That article in Spin. And I was like, they're grumbling and mumbling. And I just thought to myself, man, after all I did for this band, to be treated like this, fuck them. I wasn't able to explain to them. It didn't even occur to me. I was so shocked by their reaction that I didn't think to tell them, hey, guess what? I didn't have anything to do. The funny thing Johnny said was, well, we'd expect this from Legs McNeil, but not from you. Well, yeah, do the math, figure it out. Right?
Well, I mean,
But yeah,
did
Joey was resentful for forever about it. He never forgot a slight. No.
yeah did I mean so did he ever get past it and kind of forgive you for, I mean, realize you didn't have anything to do with it, or?
I ran into him many years later after I left High Times magazine and started hanging out again. But he always would give me kind of a weird sideways look. And we got along okay, but you could tell, you
It's
know,
different.
you still hurt.
Yeah.
Never
Well,
forgot the
yeah.
slug.
So what ended up, I mean, leading to you stopping to publish Punk Magazine, right? You ran for whatever several issues and all. What did just it not clicking, not catching on? Did you just decide, enough, enough?
Well, after Punk folded, I couldn't raise the money. We had a subscriber list of over 2,500. So, you know, I would have had to publish and mail 2,500 copies of anything, which would have been a lot of money. And I tried a lot of different angles. I tried to get a book deal, tried to get investors, even tried to sell it. I think Al Goldstein offered 10,000 for all the rights, but I didn't want to go there. So Peter Bagg showed up at the office. I think I was still doing Punk on Lafayette Street. No, maybe it was somewhere else. And he was like, "Well, how do you do it? How do you publish your own zine?" And I was like, "Well, let's just do it, and you'll see. You know, put up a couple hundred bucks." So we put out a thing called Comical Funnies. We did three issues together, but we started to split because I wanted to add more magazine type editorial and he wanted to do a standard comic book. And his comic book ended up doing great. You know, he became editor of Weirdo and worked for Fantagraphics. J.D. King and I put out Stop just for fun. I think I was doing a lot of freelance work in the early 80s after Punk folded. And I had that job at Scholastic, and doing a lot of freelance work. So I was churning out all this stuff in the early 80s. Then it all came to a stop in 1984. The video game magazines I was working with all folded. The Scholastic magazine, K-Power, I worked with folded. Bananas folded. It was shocking. Like, within a few months, all of my revenue sources dried up. So, where were we? Middle 80s.
Yeah, about ending Punk. So I mean, you had a lot going on, right? So you kind of folded Punk up, and then all of a sudden everything dried up.
Well, Punk folded when we tried to publish number 18.
Yeah.
It would have been Rock and Roll High School on the cover. And the printer, I mean, we were being published at a very high-end place because there was a family friend whose father was the president of the company. And they, even though they were doing work with the Museum of Modern Art and the Metropolitan, they were also publishing Punk. And those issues, the printing was really good. But then the president of the company divorced his wife and decided to go back to the office. He took one look at Punk and pulled us off the press and, you know, refused to honor our contract. We actually had a contract set up for to publish six issues, but we only got two of them out. So that
Gotcha.
pretty much killed us. And that was 1979. We did one more issue for the DOA movie, DOA, A Rite of Passage, because that was, you know, the whole story of Tom Forsaad, the founder of High Times. You know, he was a big fan of Punk magazine and punk rock, and so he brought Roberta Bailey and I on the tour. He committed suicide before the film was completed, so the director approached me about creating graphics for it, and then we put together like a whole magazine because they four-walled it, which meant they rented the theater and they sold magazine and they brought in all the money from the tickets, but it bombed. It did okay as a midnight movie, but nobody went to see it during the day or weeknight. So we managed to bring out one more issue after the 70s. Didn't do another one, and didn't do another issue of Punk until I brought out a small book, a best of kind of thing, in the 90s when I was publisher of High Times. And we were trying to get product into bookstores. It sold really well. That was a horrible thing. Like, Punk didn't sell well on newsstands until we were going out of business. The last two issues we did, we were making a lot of money distribution. But the music industry, after the Sid and Nancy debacle, decided Punk was dead. So we got no advertising. So we got advertising support before Sid and Nancy and none afterwards. But for some reason, the Sid and Nancy thing got all these kids more interested in punk rock. It's kind of like the rock and roll thing, like Keith Moon dies and the Who become more popular than ever, you know? Brian Jones dies and the Rolling Stones become bigger than ever. Death becomes her, you know?
So do you still hold the rights to Punk Magazine and the name and everything else that's still with you?
Oh yeah, I incorporated. I transferred all the rights in the year 2000. Because after I left High Times, I had saved up a lot of money, and I wanted to relaunch the magazine. So we brought out an issue in early 2000, and it did really well. You know, printed 10,000 copies, got them on newsstands. Tower Records at the time was doing great, and so I put together a business plan based on everything. On all the numbers, and we were going to have a meeting on September 11, and the office is 2 blocks away from the World Trade Center. So that kind of killed things, kind of killed my plans to relaunch the magazine. We always had one disaster or another. Like even in '79, you know, we put the Clash on the cover of Punk. And they were going to be on the cover of Newsweek. It would have been a big deal. But then the Clash were knocked off the cover when the Iranian hostage situation took place. You know? But my whole life has been one disaster after another.
Well, you mentioned, the best of book, whatever. Is there any, potential thought to, to doing more, collections, any more best of books, anything like that in the future?
Well, yeah, there's a 50th anniversary coming up. So I've been talking to publishers and looking into different things we can do. I got some big plans on the way. I can't reveal what they are yet because they haven't
That's right.
happened. But, I'm working with some great people, and I'm very hopeful that we can mark 1976 as the 50th anniversary of punk rock because you start with us in the first week. Of 76. And then you get the Ramones' first album in April. And you know, there will be a lot more anniversaries throughout the year. And 77 is going to be crazy, of course, because, you know, well, at the end of 76 is when the first Pistols record comes out. But then throughout 77, you know, Manic Panic's going to do something big for their 50th because they started on 7/7/77.
So as this stuff develops and unveils and you're announcing stuff, will this do you foresee it being announced on the Punk site, the Punk magazine site?
I hope so. I've had trouble finding a webmaster. If there's anybody out there who wants to help, I've had one person or another take on the assignment and then just disappear. Not many people code anymore. It's kind of weird. You know, the transition of technology is so difficult. A lot of my files are on computer disks that can't be accessed anymore because the operating system is outmoded. I can't do anything with my reel-to-reel tapes. Cassettes are making a comeback. Vinyl made a comeback, but a lot of stuff has disappeared because, you know, who uses SyQuest discs anymore? The my first book, you know, the first punk collection was on a SyQuest disc, and I actually found a place to take the images off. They'd all degraded by then. The digital decay is another thing. You know, your CDs are going to start dying. some of the digital stuff that I had on hard drives has disappeared. It's very difficult to save digital information, which I think will bring people back to analog formats. And I've noticed there's a lot more popularity in producing zines, even though most of them are just personal zines. I think the whole idea of print is making a small comeback because digital doesn't work for archiving material. You look at an issue of Punk magazine from 50 years ago, it might be a little yellow, but it's pretty much there. You know?
Yeah. I'm definitely a print guy, right? I don't do digital books or whatever. I want a physical book in my hand. And you know, there's something about that. Besides, you know, potential anniversary stuff coming up, you know, and outside Punk magazine, you have any other projects you're working on, anything you want to plug, any other work that you're doing or anything currently?
Well, we got the Joey Ramone birthday bash coming up.
Yeah, when's that?
May 19, Monday night. Miss Deborah, who's been helping host the awards since the very first, not the awards, the birthday bash, since the first one, 2001. This is the 25th anniversary.
Yeah.
It's Barrio Electric as always. And we're going to host a little thing a few blocks away. I can't give out details, but just check out our social media for Official Punk Magazine and Miss Deborah Raffles. Trezzini, she always runs the raffle that makes a lot of money for the lymphoma research. And we're looking forward to a really special birthday bash this year.
Yeah.
I'm working on a lot of other stuff, but you'll have to stay tuned for details.
I can't
actually announce things yet, but it's gonna be a big year.
So yeah, I mean, like we've talked, you've worked for, man, a very diverse list of iconic titles, right? Punk, Bananas. I think you did a little time on heavy metal. We mentioned High Time. We didn't even really talk about it, but you talked about High Time. You were, you know, majorly involved in that for a long time. We talked, you're an illustrator, right? First and foremost. So do you ever get out there and do conventions and stuff and any of that?
Yeah. I've done several cons. I was a special guest at the big San Diego con. Haven't done New York. New York's more cosplay than comics. Mm-hmm. Hoping to do the Big Apple Comic Con this year around November. Well, the best way to keep in touch with me is my Substack newsletter, johnholmstromsubstack.com. Okay. You know, I tell old war stories and print old comic strips and stuff from the old days. So all that's right. The best way to keep track of what's going on.
Well, that was my next question, how people could keep track, right? So, you know, if you're doing appearances and some announcements, I mean, that would have to be one of the first places that you'll definitely plug it there. Let's put it that way, right? I mean, very early on, you'll mention these things.
And it's free.
There you go. Well, all right.
I produce some special material for people who subscribe, but overall, you can get it all free.
Well, all right. There you go. I mean, like you said, it's been a wild journey, but with the anniversaries coming up, who knows, man, there might be a little resurgence in, I mean, nostalgia sales.
There's definitely a resurgence. Darren Aronofsky, who directed The Wrestler.
Yeah. Okay.
Swan, The Whale. He's currently producing a movie. They shot footage all over the East Village. And his movie is based on, the background is the punk rock scene in the East Village in the 1990s.
Oh, okay. Cool.
So there's just a lot of things bubbling up. A lot of punk rock bands are, punk rock's undergoing a resurgence right now.
Yeah. Like,
I meet kids, like teenagers who are starting punk bands.
Yeah, definitely is.
It's a very exciting.
Yeah, and I mean that you know, that DIY mentality will never die, right? I mean, it's even easier. I mean, in some ways now, right? For these, for you know, guys and kids to do a band and And I mean, you don't have to have a studio anymore to record some of this stuff, right? People have the technology, so there's always going to be that drive out there for people that are creative to produce things, whether it be music or zines or comics or whatever, however they want to express themselves. It'll always be there, right? Which is kind of at the heart of you starting this magazine and some of the underground comics that you were into and everything else. It's that vibe, that feel is still very alive and well.
Well, more
And
important is I think that as a society, if you're a kid growing up and you had to go through the COVID lockdown, you're pissed off at the government and you're pissed off at the establishment and everything. You know, you're angry you've been lied to. And I think that is a cultural influence on why a kid might want to start a rock and roll, a punk rock band and scream and yell and rebel, you know.
I
It's
mean,
like it all goes back to the Wild One, the Marlon Brando movie. You know, what are you rebelling against, Johnny? Says, what do you got?
Well, you got, I mean, it's, always something right at the seat, right? Social and just not being heard, right? And so trying to find a voice to yell into the ethos and get, and get it out, which, everybody needs to do, right? Everybody needs in some capacity to get that out with, their frustrations. And,
Yeah, well, there's been a conformist tendency by kids since social media took over. You know, they all want likes. You know, I mean, if I could, I would start anti-social media and get as many dislikes as possible. Piss people off. You know, you got to piss people off because you gotta think. You know, you gotta think beyond what everybody else believes
That's
and
right.
own identity and you know, develop your own ideas
Right.
and not accept the bullshit that your teachers and your parents always want you to
It's
believe.
definitely time for the young to shake it up and rise up and let their voice be heard.
And
And
old people too.
and all people too. That's right. Correct. Everybody. I mean,
Always.
everybody needs to, everybody needs to shake it up, man. It's everything. Everything needs, everything needs a
We're
little.
lied to. We were lied to about too many things, you know.
No,
We
always
gotta
are.
stop trusting politicians, you know.
There you go. Always are.
They all stink. They're all
That's
thieves
right.
and robbers. They go into office poor and leave rich. There's
That's
something
right.
wrong. We gotta
That's
stop
right.
it.
That's right. That's about as punk rock as it gets, isn't
The culture's more important than politics,
it?
you
Correct.
know.
Correct. Well, John, man, it's been a blast. It's been fun. I feel like you and I could veer off on so much stuff and talk forever, but I won't keep you any longer. Like I said, I just wanted to touch on the punk magazine and you being there, at the ground level when the Ramones and CBGBs and all that's breaking in, and being a part of that and coming up with those covers and that artwork and being a part of that. Hopefully maybe in the future we can revisit, talk again. Hopefully you'll keep me abreast as things develop in the anniversaries. And you can make announcements so that I can share that. And hopefully you'll stay in touch with me. And I'll do what I can to help support you and everything coming up.
Sounds good, and I will do the same.
Hey, Bruiser buddies, I want you to listen to Wrestling Nostalgia with Dave Dynasty. Every week, he has the roughest and toughest interviews in the podcast world today, with the best guests you could ask for. There's no bums on this show. Let Dave Dynasty be your podcasting tag team partner and listen to Wrestling Nostalgia while drinking beer, smoking cigars, and busting heads. Just look it up on your favorite podcast platform and subscribe today, because the Bruiser said so.
All right, and thank you to John for coming on and doing that interview. Next episode will be out June 1st, and my guest on that episode will be Rick Johnson, a longtime friend of the Ramones, who saw the band live 106 times. And he's also one of the coordinators for the annual Record Store Day. So remember, be sure to subscribe because that episode will be out June 1st. Thank you to all the listeners and followers. Be sure to tell your friends and fellow Ramones fans about the podcast and help us grow. Make sure you subscribe to us on your favorite podcast platform. Plus, leave a rating and review. Please be sure to follow us on social media. Like I said earlier, we're on pretty much all the platforms. Just search for Pinhead Pod. Make sure you share our post and help the podcast audience grow. You can also give us feedback, suggestions, tell us your Ramones stories, etc. on those platforms. Guys, thank you for joining me. Thank you for listening once again. Thank you to John for coming on and doing that interview with me. And until next month, be good, be safe, and gabba gabba hey.